We're learning more about the Hot Shots team, an elite unit of firefighters who battle wildfires in extreme terrain. We talked to the National Park Service firefighter spokesman Mike Thune, who knew Brian Hughes, a former Hilo resident and Hot Shot member who was killed when a tree fell on him while fighting a fierce wildfire in Ferguson, California, just a few weeks ago.
Being a hotshot is no easy task. There are minimum qualifications that firefighters have to meet to even get on a hotshot crew to begin with. From there, they can work their way up with more experience and more training. Hotshot crews are elite firefighters. They're the best of the best. They hit some of the most rugged, steepest terrain that you'll find anywhere in the world. The physical fitness requirements to be a hotshot is bar none. Not only is it being able to run, but to lift heavy weights. Hotshot crews will at minimum carry 45 pounds on their back for 16 hours a day for 14 straight days. But now add all the terrain, when there's conditions that are smoky, it definitely puts a strain on your lungs. The other part of it is you're dealing with a very dangerous situation that's dynamic and always changing.
So where is the Hotshot group based?
So within the National Park Service, there are two Hotshot crews. One is the Arrowhead Hotshots, which Brian was the captain of, and that's based in Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks. The other National Park Service Hotshot crew is the Alpine Hotshots, and they're based at Rocky Mountain National Park. Nationwide, there are over 100 hotshot crews. You can imagine that there are thousands upon thousands of firefighters all across the country, and each of these firefighters and fire personnel have different skill sets, different things that they bring to this table, essentially. So within a hotshot crew, there's a minimum of 20 people that make up a hotshot crew. So if we were to use a number just for easy math of just over 100 crews nationwide, 20 people on a crew, you're looking at just over 2,000 people only in a given year are hotshots. It's a very, very elite group of people.
And what's the difference between the hotshot group and the smoke jumpers group?
Smoke jumpers jump out of airplanes. Hotshot crews generally drive, hike into a fire. So they're ground-based versus a smoke jumper is like a paratrooper, but for fire. The National Park Service actually does not have any smoke jumpers. We work interagency. So in Boise, Idaho is the headquarters for the National Interagency Fire Center. And it's made up of all the different federal land management agencies within the United States. So it not only includes the National Park Service, it includes the U.S. Forest Service, the Bureau of Land Management, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the list goes on. Think of it like the Pentagon, but for fire. So, for example, in Boise, Idaho, where the National Interagency Fire Center is, there are smoke jumpers based out of there, and they're actually employees of the Bureau of Land Management.
You're here in Hawaii now, helping to battle that blaze up at Mauna Loa.
The Keoho Fire, that's correct.
Right. And so how long will you be here?
Because the fire is increasing in containment, like I said, it's over 90% contained. I'll actually probably be departing the islands within the next couple days to be sent to another fire somewhere else in the country. One of the things about the fire service is when tragedies like this happen, we really come together as a family. And the thing that's been the most comforting is the outpouring of support from not only other fire departments and organizations across the country and even the world, but even the public. It really means a lot to us to see people lined up when we had the procession in Hilo just this last week, to see the public standing on the side of Kamehameha and watching those vehicles drive through really means a lot to us.
You also had another service in California, right?
We did. At the service in California, it was held in Fresno. Over 1,500 people attend, and this included other hotshot crews, other fire staff from Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Park, the National Park Service, our brothers and sisters from the U.S. Forest Service, and other fire departments.
Is there any memory you'd like to share with us just about Brian and your time working with him with the Hotshot Group?
Brian was a firefighter's firefighter. He looked after his crew. He looked after the women and men that worked on his crew. He ensured that everybody knew what they were doing, why they were doing it. Brian really made sure that people had opportunities to gain experience, to move up in the ranks if they wanted to. He took his job very seriously, but he also knew how to make you feel at home.
Do you know how he got involved in the Hotshots?
Brian started out as a firefighter in Colorado and worked his way through the ranks on different fire crews. He was at one point on the Midnight Suns Hotshot crew and other Hotshot crews before joining Arrowhead in 2015 as the Hotshot crew captain. I've spent some time in Hawaii. I actually went to school at UH Manoa and worked at the park here, and Brian and I shared memories of Hawaii, and one of the things that I will most remember about Brian is how much he embodied that aloha spirit. I work with the crews to help tell their story. I tie in with them on prescribed burns, wildfires, things like that. So what we do have on the fires, we have a couple crews from the mainland. One is the Folsom Lake Veterans Crew, and which is based out of Folsom Lake, California. And then we also have what's known as the Kuia Wild and Fire Module, and they're based at Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks as well. It's not common for us to travel all the way to Hawaii, but being that we're national parks and we share resources and we help each other out, especially when those needs arise, to have that opportunity to come to Hawaii Volcanoes National Park and battle the Kauai fire with all the things going on within the state is a real honor for us. The reality is you're not going to eliminate risk completely. Firefighting, as many people are aware, is a dangerous occupation. We do it because we love it. We do it because we care about the land and the people. But if we can learn how to do things differently the next time, then we're absolutely going to do that.
That was Mike Thune, a friend of Hilo's fallen firefighter Brian Hughes. Thune works as public information officer for the National Park Service and the Hotshot Group. Hughes died battling the California wildfire earlier this month. That blaze, the largest in that state's history, apparently claimed yet the life of another firefighter just this week. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In 1883, before the Alawai Canal, Kapiolani Park was a watery region of swamps and ponds dotted with islands. The largest of these man-made islands was a popular destination for the locals. It was a rectangle measuring roughly 100 by 700 feet in the northwest corner of the park, where Kapahulu Road became Kapahulu Avenue. This large island was forested with ironwood trees, date and coconut palms, and kaave. It was the site of the first Kapiolani Park bandstand, where the Royal Hawaiian Band performed on Sunday afternoons. To get there, you either rode or walked one of several narrow wooden plank bridges. Picnickers, strollers, and people with romance on their minds frequented the secluded spot. Do you know the name of this popular island? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people that you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Bishop Museum, presenting Unreal, Hawaii in Popular Imagination, an exhibit that sets up a conversation about Hawaii as depicted in archival commercial art versus contemporary reality, now through January 27th.
Election always ends with winners and losers. We check in with HPR's political reporter Wayne Yoshioka for what's next on the horizon for these folks.
Well, we looked at the election results from the primary, and it's 6 days after the August 11th election, and we find that Governor David Ige did really well in urban Honolulu, and on the Big Island, Josh Green did really well. So their pairing, I think, will be a formidable, formidable partnership, and they look like they're going to breeze through that general election like nobody's business.
I know, and I think when we were talking earlier, I'd mentioned that, being at David Ige's campaign headquarters the last time around, you could really see his loyal base.
Correct. And, the Hawaii State Teachers Association, they've backed him for the last two elections, and they are a really onerous cadre of volunteers. They get out there early, and they sign wave like nobody's business. And I think that's going to make a big difference. But Josh Green can hold his own, I think, on the Big Island. He won that hands down over his nearest competitor, Jill Tokuda, 3-1. So I think they're going to be really tough to beat. David Ige lost to Colleen Hanabusa on the Big Island, so by about a few hundred votes. But having Josh Green on that team is going to make a big difference.
Right. So you've got two folks on the Democratic Party who seem to get along, and there's some synergy there. But on the Republican side, they're having some issues.
Not so much. Yeah. We have a Republican gubernatorial candidate, Andrea Tupola, who is not talking to her running mate, Marissa Kearns. And that's going to be really tough because there are 250,000 Democrats that voted in the election, 8-1 over the Republicans. And if they're not, cohesive and working as a team, they're going to have a really tough time. I see some votes going to Andrea Tupola from Colleen Hanabusa out in the leeward area, leeward Oahu. But other than that, it looks pretty dismal for the Republican team.
Yeah, I know. And with the voter turnout, I know folks say that, folks maybe don't turn out because we don't have a strong two-party system, and you kind of wish you could, do something and inject something into that Republican Party to get a healthy dialogue going and some real competition.
Real competition, but, I think voter turnouts, it was 38% during the primary election. It's going to be dismal during the general election because people know that David Ige and Josh Green are going to win. So why go out and vote if you outnumber the Republicans 8-1?
Well, you have to because there are very important issues coming up on the general election ballot. You've got the Constitutional Convention issues. You've got charter amendments.
And, on the county level as well as the state level. So, yes, that's something that you should turn out for. And really, just go out there and vote. I mean, they have other races throughout the state, and, some of them are still contested. So go out there and vote and really at least have your say.
And you and I have been around the block a few times, and sometimes when it gets to those long questions, people are like, oh, what do we do? And so you really kind of have to bone up and educate yourself before you get to the polls to understand what the issues are.
Correct. And especially when you have a legislative introduced constitutional amendments. I mean, they go through two fact checks. They're weighed against the majority. Then they're also weighed against the not counted votes, the blank votes. And it's a real complicated formula. So if you don't vote and you leave it blank, there's a chance that it might not carry over.
Right. And I know that Common Cause has that app where they're trying to educate voters before they go out, the Power app. So hopefully folks will bone up before November.
At least weigh in on some of the issues that there are there. And we did experience, I guess, some upsets in the Senate with Sharon Moriwaki beating incumbent Rickwood Galateria in a District 12 of the State Senate in Kaka'ako. That was a big upset. And I think the other upset was in Waimea and Hala'ula, State Representative District 7, where David Tarnas beat incumbent Cindy Evans. So those were the highlights, I guess, from the primary election going into the general election, which is only 80-plus days away.
And you've reached out to some of those candidates to talk about their experiences, first-timers, and actually getting in. Because I remember with Sharon, I used to see her at the HCDA meetings, and I think that's where she kind of built a base.
Correct. She was primarily with, what's that, Kaka'ako now, or with that group. But she was also on the cabinet of John Waihe'e. So she's a very experienced candidate, at least from the sidelines. And she really put up a big fight for that seat. And I think Rickwood Galateria, I didn't see him. You know, he's usually on the corner of Ward and Kapiolani Avenue, I mean Boulevard, and he's usually sign-waving, but there was an absence that he wasn't there. So he really didn't show the voters that I want this job like Sharon did.
And what do you think happened on the Big Island race, though, with Cindy Evans?
Oh, Cindy Evans? I don't know. I wasn't there, so I don't know the area. But that whole Waimea area, I mean, it's hard to reach. The houses are far apart. So, and I think David, you know, put up a pretty good campaign where he went out there and said, I'm visible and I want to work for you. Where Cindy Evans was, you know, was the floor leader for the House, so she really didn't have a big committee or a big presence in that legislative session. So I think that's part of the problem.
And you've been chatting with some of the winners and losers, and I know you reached out to Doug Chin, his first time in an elected office.
Correct. And he's an attorney, and he's not used to being an extrovert, and he really was tested in terms of getting out there, putting himself out there, and having to have that salesmanship and selling himself. And I talked to him, and it was a great conversation. I think he's going to be someone to contend with in the future. I'm also going to talk to Sharon Moriwaki tomorrow, so that should be another interesting insight into what it takes as a first-time runner running for office, for any political office at all.
Right, because I remember with Doug Chin, he worked as the city managing director for Mayor Peter Carlisle. So that's how he kind of jumped into that.
And he was also the attorney general who fought the Trump administration. So, but he had to put himself out there. And I think the hardest part is to put your family out there and say, okay, we are running as a family, and to have all your children and your wife go, ooh, that's beyond our comfort zone. So it takes a lot.
Yeah, because I'm sure there were some interesting conversations. They had to kind of turn the stone around. What is this going to mean to our lives?
Right, and I think it's changed forever. And I think just knowing Doug Chin, he's got that. He's been smitten with that political bug, and I think he's going to run again. I'm pretty sure he's going to run again because he likes it.
And so do you know what Congresswoman Colleen Hanabusa is going to do?
No, I haven't talked to her. You know, she stays in office until January, so that gives her some time to weigh her options.
Right, and she's a labor attorney.
Correct. So she can go back into practice. She's got her legislative retirement and 6 years in Congress. She's got her congressional retirement. So she's not going to be hurting for any reason at all.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Wayne.
Thank you.
That was HPR's political reporter, Wayne Yoshioka. You can find his stories online at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
HPR supporters have watched Danny Carvalho grow from teenage slack key prodigy to band leader, producer, and working musician. He has recently teamed with singer-songwriter and hula dancer Nani Edgar to form Kailua Moon. Catch them and their fresh sound in the Atherton on Saturday the 25th. Call HPR during business hours or go to hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
It's time now for Reality Check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Nick Gruby has a story about how our Hawaii congressional delegation and where they parked their money. Hi, Nick.
Hi, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
So what did you find out when you went looking through those records?
Well, financial disclosures are one of the basic congressional records that reporters like to look at. I mean, if you just look at President Donald Trump and his financial disclosures, every year many members of the press go in and they sort of read through to see where our elected officials are putting their personal assets and what can come of that. I think with President Trump, we've learned that he, at least some of his assets, are earning more money for him now that he's president. So what I did is I just wanted to go look at the members of our federal delegation to see what they were doing with their money. And usually these reports are due in May, but three of the four members of our delegation filed extensions, which meant that their reports weren't due until this week. Now, what was in those reports? It's a little across the board, depending on what you're looking at. So, for instance, Representative Tulsi Gabbard, she recently invested in some cryptocurrency, which is similar to Bitcoin, which is a complicated sort of online investment platform that is involves mining for Bitcoin and all of that. She also received some reimbursements for a trip she took to Armenia in 2017. Now, the other members of our delegation, Senators Brian Schatz, Mazie Hirono, and Colleen Hanabusa, for instance, they all have their state pensions that they're still earning income off of. And Colleen Hanabusa and Mazie Hirono in particular, their financial disclosures show that they are two of the most affluent of the four members in that they are both considered millionaires, or at least their net worth is above $1 million, which in 2014 what most members of Congress for the first time in history would be considered as millionaires.
Now, I imagine that they own property here, you know, in Honolulu and maybe even in D.C. I think I recall Senator Dan Inouye had a unit in both places.
Right, yeah, and if you look through the financial disclosures, they do own homes, and some of them own homes in both places. And, you know, you'll also see some will have rental units come to the top of mind. I think Representative Tulsi Gabbard and Senator Mazie Hirono, I believe, both earn rental income and off of units they have in either Washington and or Honolulu.
What about any additional income they might have for giving speeches?
So that's something that you would tend to find in there. They're supposed to list these in their financial disclosures. But in this case, not a single member of the delegation reported earning any income. And of course, they have to report whether they receive more than $200 of that income in order to report it. Even if the money is given to them and then donated to charity, they have to list that. But as of 2017, the end of 2017, none of them had reported receiving that sort of income on their financial disclosures.
Yeah, interesting. All right. Okay. Well, thanks, Nick. We appreciate you checking in there.
All right. Thank you, Catherine.
That was Nick Gruby with today's Reality Check. To read his full story, visit civilbeat.org. Bill Dorman is HPR's news director. He joins us in studio with a look at what's happening next week.
Yeah, some interesting things. You know, you and Wayne were talking about actually a little bit lessons from the election and all. And one of the things that he's doing next week is this idea of looking at folks who ran for the first time and that experience. And you mentioned Doug Chin, first congressional district, and his background in terms of community government service, really, former attorney general, former prosecutor, former city managing director, but the first election campaign. And Sharon Moriwaki, coming in neighborhood activism, Kakak United for about 10 years, but also, as Wayne pointed out, that she was in the cabinet previously. But that idea of going from also at UH for a while, by the way, but that idea of going from a non-political career to run for office, that is a pretty severe mid-career course adjustment.
Right. She was married to a former legislator, so I'm sure had the insight as
right.
to, you know, how a campaign is run and,
right.
and who the right shakers and movers are to connect to.
Yeah, absolutely. But I'm looking forward to sort of seeing Wayne's insights on that in terms of some of the talks.
And so what else is happening with Kuvehi in Niue?
So we've got a bit going. Actually, something interesting from the Big Island, from Sherry Bracken. There's a movie that is opening on the mainland now, actually today, Running for Grace. It's a small film. It's about plantation life, shot on the Big Island. Matt Dillon is in it, a couple of other big names. But it was shot locally. On the Big Island, about $2.5 million production in the local economy, and produced and developed here as well, Honua Studios on the Big Island. And this is the largest independent film studio in the state. It's a public-private partnership, involves state money from Hawaii, involves private investors as well. And now there are about, and this fired up a few years back, Hawaii County actually put money in at the beginning back, I think around 2014 or so. Now they've got about 30 companies working out of here.
Really?
And
wow.
It's really, yeah, so it's interesting to, Sherry Bracken's going to be recapping a bit of that and sort of pointing out some of the folks involved in that movie locally as well. And local voices, speaking of, Quinn Kelsey, the Mighty Quinn. That's a name, local voice, familiar to a lot of our listeners.
Fabulous pipes.
Oh, my goodness. Opera singer, you know, he's a baritone. You know, and to put it that way, it's like saying, oh, yeah, Barack Obama dabbled in politics. But he debuted with the Met in New York a decade ago now, sang the Royal Opera in London, international companies
around
the world. Yeah, right? But Noe is talking to him not just about upcoming performance, but how he was influenced and formed by experiences growing up here in Honolulu, and that's an interesting take on that. One other on the other side of the music scale, actually, although also someone very familiar with classical music, Stephen Katkur, one of the founding members of the reggae group Third World, he's got an incredible story. Son of a former deputy prime minister of Jamaica, grew up with a lot of influences, including classical music. He plays guitar, but he also plays cello. And he sat down with Dave Lawrence in our Atherton studio to talk and to believe it or not, to play his cello.
Oh, there you go.
And talk
a
about
different.
That. So that's coming up this afternoon on All Things Considered. So that's a real treat coming
okay.
up.
All right. Thanks, Bill. Bill Dorman is HPR's news director. Earlier this week, we talked about sleep disorders, and we heard back from you on our talkback line. AJC wrote in, currently enjoying the conversation's discussion of sleep disorders and the importance of sleep in people's lives. It makes me wonder about the impact of homelessness on people's health, as it's often difficult to get consistent sleep or sleep of adequate duration, especially with the so-called compassionate disruption campaign being waged against people experiencing homelessness. Cynthia said, my husband has a CPAP device for a year, and after a sleep study, diagnosed sleep apnea, and after years of sleep apnea, he feels such a difference in his energy and alertness using CPAP that he takes it with him on all his trips, including to Bhutan, and he's now on a camping trip and boat trip to the North Shore of Molokai. Aloha, and keep up the great work. P.S. His PAP machine, his CPAP machine is so quiet, I sleep much better now that he is not snoring loudly. And Livett shared this perspective on the U.S. Supreme Court's landmark labor decision, Janus. It's all well and good for state employees, myself included, to be able to opt out of paying union dues, but it's only fair that those employees choosing not to belong should not reap the many benefits of belonging to a union, negotiated pay increases, representation and protection from unfair labor practices, negotiated discount programs for various consumer products, such as the 15% discount for cell phone service. No pay, no play. Otherwise, you'll be a freeloader. Well, thanks for that feedback. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter, or call our Talkback line, 792-8217.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Wealth Jar, Hawaii Pacific University, and locations.
In Greek mythology, Hector was a Greek prince and a great fighter during the Trojan Wars. And just a few weeks ago, the Hector we knew was the hurricane skirting us our shores, bringing surf and a bit of wind. We thought it was time to refresh our memories about the process that meteorologists use to pick the names of storms headed our way. We sat down with John Brabender with the National Weather Service.
The hurricane names are, they get named in whatever basin they form in. There's the Eastern Pacific Basin that's located east of 140 west longitude. The Central Pacific Basin, which our office forecasts for, between 140 west and the international dateline. Depending on where a tropical cyclone forms, it develops into a storm initially, 39 miles an hour. Depending on where it strengthens, it gets a name from that area. In the East Pacific, it's an alphabetical list, very similar to the Atlantic, where each system has its name. It goes A, B, C, D. It goes down the list. We get to Hector before we get one to move into this far west. If it formed in the Central Pacific, it gets a name from – it gets a Hawaii name from a different list. And because we have fewer cyclones develop here and get named here, we don't reset every year. So where one list drops off, we start up again at that point the next year.
Okay, so it's not that often that you will get then a storm with a Hawaiian name.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so who determines what names are on the list? How does that work?
It's actually an international collaboration. The World Meteorological Organization has committees that meet to decide, you know, international convention, you know, standards that all countries follow. And one of the things they do is develop these lists of names for each basin. All the countries in that region get together and agree on which ones they'll use. So all countries will use the same names so to avoid confusion. The lists are set up now. We cycle through them. When there's a significant hurricane, a lot of damage or loss of life, the same WMO committee that meets to determine the names can also decide to retire a name. To avoid being disrespectful to people who lost loved ones during one later, that sort of situation. And when they retire a name, then the members get together to decide what new name to replace it with.
So like Hurricane Katrina, name is probably retired.
Yeah, we won't see another Katrina again. The last Central Pacific name that was retired was EOK in 2006. Also, Iniki was retired, so we won't see another Iniki. within the Central Pacific Basin, we have four different lists that have about a dozen names on them. You go down them alphabetically and then restart from the top of the next list when you go through one. For the East Pacific and the Atlantic, there's six different lists that they cycle through. So you could see the same names come up again every 6 years. They start with A and then move down the list. In 2016, we had caused a bit of confusion when we had Madeline and Lester approaching the islands from the east. Madeline came first and then Lester. And people were confused because why does the M come before the L? It just happened that Lester formed first farther east, closer towards Mexico, and was therefore slower to get here. So it's based on when they form.
And what about the names, female names versus male names?
Right now, they alternate male and female names. Gilma as the G, Hector as the H, and then Lane as the L, for example. Or in the case in 2016, Madeline Lester. In the Western Pacific, for the typhoon list, the typhoon committee that meets, different countries that are members of that committee have names. So they alternate one country to the next. So I guess I would suppose that if one country's name gets retired, that country can propose the next one. On the hurricane website, or mm-hmm. just the Central Pacific Hurricane Center website, there's have a page that has the list of all the names for the different basins. And they also talk about the country of origin for the Western Pacific names, so you can get an idea. And also have some pronunciations, because that can be tricky at times. Once a tropical storm or hurricane gets named, it will keep that name as it moves across the ocean. So if it, like Hector formed in the east, stayed as a hurricane as it moves through the Central Pacific, if it moves past the international dateline, then it will become Typhoon Hector. It keeps the same name depending on whatever basin it is. A tropical depression, as it starts developing, it doesn't get a name initially. It's given a number. One, two, three, going down sequentially. Once it becomes a tropical storm, then it's given a name. On the other end, as it's weakening and dissipating, as it weakens to a depression, it's still referred to as the name. So you could have Tropical Depression Darby, for example, moving past us. But if you have, for example, Tropical Depression 1C that hit the Big Island back in the 90s, brought some significant flooding to Hilo, that was something that had developed to a tropical storm, but obviously still brought pretty significant impacts from the flooding threat.
When you do the storms, when you give them numbers, assign them numbers, how does that work?
So that's one of the things during hurricane season we're constantly watching. We do a tropical weather outlook four times a day where we're looking for areas of potential development. As we're watching that, something come together, thunderstorms start rotating, come together. There's certain ingredients you look for. Low pressure system, persistent thunderstorms, things like that. As it becomes more organized, then we'll decide it's a depression, and we start issuing advisories on it. That's the point where you start to see like a forecast track, mm-hmm. Error cone, potential impacts, the full hurricane advisory package. Once it becomes strong enough, once it reaches wind speeds of 40 miles an hour, tropical storm force, then we give it a name.
And again, if you haven't heard, the next name on the hurricane list is Lane. So Hurricane Lane is headed our way, so pay attention next week. We were talking with John Ravender of the National Weather Service. This hurricane season, between 3 to 6 storms are forecast. Hurricane season expected to last through November. In today's quiz, we're wondering if you can tell us the name of a famed island in the watery region of what is today Kapi'olani Park. The island was named after James McKee, a Scottish whaling ship captain, one of King Kalakaua's poker buddies, and the Kapi'olani Park Association's first president. He came to Hawaii in 1843 after being wounded in a Honolulu waterfront brawl. He moved to Maui and bought the Ulupalakua Ranch. He was a colorful and well-liked local figure, a reflection of how the island got the name McKee's Island. It had a lifespan of less than 50 years. Its history coincides with the overthrow of the monarchy in 1893 and the failed counter-revolution of 1895. At the time of the 1998 annexation, the U.S. Army used Kapi'olani Park as a staging ground for military action. The Army made repeated complaints about the park's mosquito-infested lagoons, and as a result, the legislature appropriated $100,000 for the excavation of a drainage canal, the Alawai Canal, which would render Waikiki dry and ripe for development, thus ending the life of McKee's Island. And congratulations to Peg Sullivan Miller of Chinatown. You got it right. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Got a bee in your bonnet? Well, we do have something that can fix that. We sat down with Ethel Villalobos of the University of Hawaii's Honeybee Project to give us the ABCs of basic beekeeping and to talk about an intensive workshop in Waimanalo that starts at the end of the month.
There's several advantages, I guess, to participate in a class like this. One is that we have equipment that you can borrow through the class. It's a six-week class. It meets 3 hours per class, so it's 18 hours of contact. And most of it, the great majority, is hands-on. So we'll be in the field. We have about 50 colonies of bees. So you'll work in small groups. You'll really get a feel for what it's like to have bees, to see them bring honey, to see them not do so well, to have to treat for diseases. So the fact that we spread out the instruction over, you know, several weeks allows you to get a good feel for the process.
So it's really a deep dive with the honeybees.
It is a deep dive, but it's an enjoyable deep dive because you also get to meet other people that are in the same kind of stage. And it's going to be me, and it's going to be my grad student, Scott. So it's a pretty lively little group with a lot of experience teaching.
So how is it that you have 50 colonies?
We have 50 colonies for research in Waimanalo, where we're going to be holding. So, and I have 4 grad students. So between all of us, we take care of these colonies. And it's really nice to have that diversity because you'll get to see strong colonies, weak colonies, colonies that are being fed to increase productivity, colonies that have a disease. So it is a very active research area, but also we want to be able to translate that research into outreach and hands-on, you know.
Now, recently we had a situation on the Big Island with the lava inundation, and that affected a number of folks that actually breed queen bees.
Yes, it did. Luckily, is not as bad right now. I do have contacts on the Big Island. They did, at some point, they were getting ash over the plants, ash over the flowers. These bees have always been dealing with a certain amount of vog, which makes rain acidic. So these bees, you know, they're hardened little cookies already in the Big Island in Kona. But yes, this was an extreme situation, a prolonged situation. Queen breeders, though, on the Big Island are very attentive to their bees. They need to have very strong colonies to be able to produce queens for export and in very good health because they get monitored for a certain level of sand. You know, they have to be incredibly strong colonies and in good health. So because of that attentiveness, I think they didn't suffer as badly as, you know, a regular beekeeper.
Okay, pretty resilient community out there.
Yeah.
And so tell us, now we just had a close call with the storm, with Hurricane Hector. What happens when you have, let's say, a hurricane come through? How do you deal with that?
Well, there's the immediate. For example, what we do usually is we go and strap our colonies. We actually put big seatbelts, kind of. We tie them all together. I mean, each colony is made of several boxes. So we try to tie them, those boxes together, and the weight of those colonies, it can be 200 pounds, you know. So they usually stay in place. Our biggest concern is trees nearby, that a branch can fall and, you know, there's not much you can do. And then also the next couple of days, if it's really rainy or really windy, they may be not able to go forage. So if there were stressing, we might feed them afterwards. But in general, tying them down with a basically one of those heavy-duty straps does the trick. Recently, with all the climate change and all the changes in rainfall patterns and everything, we've been noticing that bees are going through times of basically very low food availability for them. So one of my grad students has been working on trying different combinations of pollen and artificial pollen that has a lot of protein and some basically sugar water to keep them afloat so that when conditions improve, they can pick up and be in better shape rather than let them use up all their reserves and be very weak when the good times come. So we're working basically on that diet modification to try to basically pass the information to beekeepers and to make them aware that you can do this manipulation safely to get the bees in good shape throughout the year.
Right, just to supplement their diet, mm-hmm. if yes. it will, just to make them, giving them their daily vitamins.
No, and it is super important because it is through their diet that their immune systems pump up. So diseases are less likely to take hold in the colony if you're well fed. So it is crucial that you keep basically a fat bee. A fat bee is a happy bee, is a healthy bee. So, you know, if I were a bee, I would be in good shape. So,
okay.
But it really is a good thing for them to have that nutrition and that diversity. So even though the supplements are not ideal, maybe in variety, they will keep them afloat until they can, you know, encounter more natural food that is best for them.
Right. We hear stories about, oh, there's pesticide in the honey. I mean, well, how do you view that?
Bees are a sponge and collect and get in touch with a lot of chemicals that you want and some that you don't, I suppose, in the fields. However, honey production is actually, they do filter a lot of things. Actually, the poor things filter a lot of things in their own bodies. Basically, I have done studies in the honey in Hawaii, and basically it's come out mostly clean, by and large clean, much more than you would in the mainland. And that has made me very happy. Recently, there was a report of some pesticides in Kauai, and that is a concern. I guess we always want to keep our eyes open where the bees are placed. If it were my call, I guess I would basically put out sentinel hives in areas that I think are prone or that I know are being sprayed with something and sample them regularly to see if indeed is what it is, if it's happening, rather than take honey from, you know, a store and a shelf that you don't know how old it is or how it was collected, because chemicals can be in the wax and from the wax it can pass to honey. So, you know, the way into which chemicals can get to honey is diverse. It can be that the flowers were contaminated, or it can be that the wax in which they stored the honey was contaminated. So you got to be really careful about how you interpret some of these results. But I would recommend that if anybody has concerns, that a more controlled study be done with sentinel hives and, you know, near production areas or other areas that are problematic with pesticides to confirm and determine how, if this is happening and how it's happening.
And sometimes I've seen honey, it's like organic honey, but what does that mean?
There's organic and there's raw honey and there's regular honey. The organic requires that a honeybee colony is situated far away from anything that could potentially be sprayed.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a in a sense, a distance, a radius that is protected, and which you can, the beekeeper needs to certify that it's surrounded, say, by forest, and there's no pesticides there. So people in some areas of Molokai have organic honey because they weigh on one side of Molokai and they're completely surrounded by native vegetation, so they can do that. The other honey, the raw honey, is honey that the beekeeper can tell you that they themselves have not used any chemicals for medicines, antibiotics, or other kinds of medicines to alter the honey, that they have not added anything, that is pure honey. Now, of course, you can't guarantee, you know, you can't interview, you know, bee number 358 where it went, so there's a chance that the bee did encounter some pesticides. However, like I said, honey tends to be among the cleanest things in the hive.
Just because there's natural filters.
It's naturally filtered, and a good beekeeper will keep their combs, their wax combs, be replacing them regularly. So pesticides get, in a sense, removed out of the hive. The beekeeper has a good management system.
Because I often hear, too, like if I'm an urban beekeeper, you might be exposed to more household stuff that people are using in the gardens, and they don't know how to apply it. And
I think there's a lot, and we do go over this in the class, too. Like, there's a lot of education that needs to be passed on to the backyard beekeeper. I mean, beekeeper and farmer, because there's people who keep, you know, fruit trees, who keep, and they just go crazy with a spray bottle, you know, and there's a lot less control sometimes to what they're using than compared to farms that need to meet certain requirements, have spray schedules, and, you know, may be supervised.
Right, but all that folks will be able to learn in this Beekeeping 101.
Oh, yeah. Yes. So it's a very broad everything from the hands-on, how do you build a box for the bees, where do you get the materials, what is the life cycle about bees, you know, what are the flowers that in Hawaii are good for bees and some that are not so great, and a whole array of things. And again, this is why we use the six-week period, because we'll be able to see problems and successes in the field. And I think that's super valuable. And we're hoping to be able to offer a part two eventually.
That was Ethel Villalobos of the Honeybee Project at the University of Hawaii. For more information on this story, check out our webpage at hawaiipublicradio.org.
She's an angel of the first degree. She's the sweetest tupelo, honey. Just like honey, baby, from the bee.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ekahi Ornish Lifestyle Medicine, Ulupono Initiative, and Impact Hub Honolulu Co-Working.
That's it for this week. Coming up next week, scientists are on the hunt for small whales and dolphins in waters off Kauai. We'd like to hear from you. Call our talkback line and leave your comments. And if you've ever wondered about the music you hear on the show, you can find the playlist on our page at hawaiipublicradio.org. That's where you can listen back to today's show. This program is produced by Lillian Song, Ryan Finnerty, and Amber Congrusby. Mahalo to John DeMello for our backyard quiz theme. I'm Catherine Cruz, and I almost forgot. Happy Statehood Day. Come back and join us on Monday and pick up the conversation.